you very much for coming. I've got the nice thing. I'm introducing someone else who's going to introduce Adam and Philippe, which is nice. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Abigail Morris, the director here of the Jewish Museum. And it's a real pleasure because it's really delightful that we are celebrating the United Nations adopting the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was 70 years ago today, is that right? Which is fantastic. So we're really excited, and we're really also chuffed to be working with Renika San. And we're going to introduce Mia in a moment, and she's going to introduce everyone else. And I'm just going to make a plug. If you haven't visited our two exhibitions that we've got at the moment, there's Kinder Transport in the ground floor, and on the third floor is Roman Vishniak. The Kinder Transport is just a small exhibition, but a very important one, telling the story of just a few of the stories of the people who came over after Kristallnacht, and who are very much part of our education program, which is a big part of the museum. We reach about 20,000 kids a year, 96% of them aren't Jewish. So it's a very important way of building bridges and creating a better world so that those kind of events don't happen again. And the Vishniak images, we also see very much the world that happened before the huge genocide that was the Holocaust. So very much a museum doesn't always deal so directly with these things, but it's very intimately connected. And both exhibitions are very moving and thought-provoking, so I would urge you to come and see them. I think I'll just stop. Oh, it's all right. Yeah, if people turn their phones off, it's cool. So thank you. And Mia, I just think we'll come and say we're really chuffed to have you. Sorry, I'm going to stand in front of you, Adam. We're really, really chuffed to have, really chuffed to have you both here. A long relationship with Philippe and the museum and personally. And obviously he's going to talk about East West Street and genocide and crimes against humanity. My youngest daughter actually just said something funny about how she said, "Oh, genocide, we're always doing genocide in our house," she said. she said, "That's all we talk about," she said, which was quite funny. And but anyway, it's not true actually. So obviously to occasionally talk about other things. But we're celebrating heroes today. So actually it's quite celebratory. So I think in amongst the gloom and doom, which there is quite a lot of today, I'd have thought, in various places, it is really nice to be celebratory, which is what we try and do at the museum too. So I will look forward to this evening. And
thank you, Abigail. My name is Mia, and I am the director of Renee Kassan, the Jewish Voice for Human Rights. We work to promote and protect human rights in the UK, drawing on Jewish values and Jewish experience. Today is a special day, not because of what's happening with Brexit, but because it is the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the role that our namesake René Cassin had in its creation. It is his legacy, or this legacy, that has inspired us, the René Cassin Organization, to make the Jewish case for human rights in the UK, raising awareness on some of the most pressing human rights issues today, and making sure that the Jewish community, driven by experience and values, is a strong voice in the promotion and protection of human rights in the UK. As René Cassin himself said, "Human rights are an integral part of the faith and tradition of Judaism. The beliefs that man, and I will add, and women, or woman, were created in the divine image, that the human family is one, and that every person is obliged to deal justly with every other person, are basic sources of the Jewish commitment to human rights." So today we are celebrating that legacy, but we're also remembering the origins of that legacy. We're celebrating because the Declaration was the first expression of a global consensus that the rights of every human being were paramount and must be respected. But remembering too, because the Declaration was a response to the horrors of the Holocaust and the atrocities that had taken place. Earlier today, I spoke at an assembly at my younger son's primary school, and I invited the school to join my human rights party, celebrating human rights. So tonight, I have two special guests joining me in inviting you to our human rights party to celebrate and remember the legacies of three remarkable Jewish human rights heroes. I'm very pleased and actually quite excited, not just pleased, to have Philippe Sands and Adam Wagner with us here tonight. Philippe is a professor of law and director of the Centre on International Courts and Tribunals at University College London and practicing barrister in Matrix Chambers. As a specialist in international law, he has been involved in many important cases in recent years, and to name just a few, Pinochet, Iraq, the Yazidis, Rwanda, making the human rights case on behalf of those whose human rights were denied. He's also the author of 16 books on international law, including his most recent book, East-West Street, which has been awarded numerous prizes, but also captures so beautifully, alongside his personal family story, what's Jewish about human rights, and the unique stories of Hirsch Lauterpacht and Raphael Lemkin, Jewish human rights heroes who sowed the seeds for modern human rights law as we know it today. Our second guest speaker is Adam Wagner. Adam is a human rights barrister, blogger, and activist. In 2010, Adam founded the UK Human Rights Blog, and in 2015, he founded the charity Rights Info, which builds knowledge and support for human rights in the UK by producing engaging, accessible, and beautifully presented online human rights content. He's also, in my view, one of the most engaging speakers I've heard in articulating the importance of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the work of René Cassin, the individual, not the organization, as the origin of the modern legal human rights framework of today. I'm nearly done. So for the next hour or so, we will hear from Philippe and Adam, the remarkable stories of Hirsch Lauterpacht, Raphael Lemkin, and René Cassin. We'll be invited to listen into a conversation between Philippe and Adam, and then open it up for questions from you at the end. So without any further ado, over to you, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Mia, and thank you to René Cassin for hosting this. It's a wonderful and important organization, and if you haven't joined it, you should, because it needs help, and human rights needs help, and the rule of law needs help. It's also fantastic to be here with Adam. I'm going to second what Mia said. His work has been extraordinary, and Rights Info filled an extraordinarily important gap and has become a place of first visit for so many of these issues, so it's incredibly nice to be here. We're, I think, going to divide up slightly. I'm going to take Lauterpacht and Lemkin, he's going to take Cassin, and then we'll talk amongst ourselves and throw it over to you, but we definitely don't want to hog and talk constantly. We do want your questions and your issues. Many of you will have read East-West Street, so I don't think I have to spend too much time going into the background. It was a completely unexpected and accidental book and a completely unexpected and accidental story. I received an invitation, as you know, to give a lecture in this obscure Ukrainian city of Lviv at a law faculty. I accepted basically because my grandfather was born in the town that Lviv used to be, namely Lemberg or Lvov, depending on whether he was speaking in German or in Polish. And I just really wanted to find the house where he was born, actually. It all started as simply as that. And that was my aim. That was why I accepted the invitation. That was why I went to Lviv in the autumn of 2010 for the first time. That was why I asked my mum if she had any documents from that period, because without any documents, I wouldn't be able to find the address on the street, which is what I wanted. And happily, she did have documents, as those of you who've read the book will know. I spent a bit of that summer in 2010 writing the lecture that I was going to give. They had asked me to talk about the work that I do on crimes against humanity and genocide. As I think many of you will now know, the accent of the two is slightly different. Crimes against humanity focuses on the protection of individuals. Genocide focuses on the protection of groups, and I'll come back to say a bit more about that. I was pretty astonished to discover, as I did my research, having spent pretty much all of my academic and barristerial professional life working on these issues, of the connection between the two concepts and the city I was going to visit. Hirsch Lauterpacht was born in a small town called Zhulkiev, about 25 kilometers to the north of Lvov, Lemberg, Lviv, and moved in 1911 to the bigger city, where he enrolled in 1915 at the law faculty and spent 4 years there before going off to Vienna, and then in 1923 coming here to London with his new wife, Rachel. In 1945, on July the 29th to be precise, he is the person who suggested to the principal prosecutor at the Nuremberg trial that the concept of crimes against humanity as a legal term of art should be integrated into the Nuremberg Charter and become a part of international law. I didn't know, and the folks who invited me from the University of Lviv didn't know, that Lauterpacht was one of theirs, so to speak. He had been a student at the law faculty that had invited me, and I thought, when I stumbled accidentally across that discovery, having read, and I just didn't pick it up the first time, Elie Lauterpacht's biography of his father, how amazing that I'm going to turn up in Lviv and share with them this extraordinary news that it all started here. And then, of course, I stumbled across the second coincidence, which was exactly the same thing had happened to Raphael Lemkin, that Raphael Lemkin had been a student a little after Lauterpacht, from 1921 to 1926, at exactly the same law school in the same city. And he, in November 1944, as chapter 9 of his book, Axis Rule, invented the expression. I mean, Lauterpacht didn't invent the term crimes against humanity. Lauterpacht sort of eased it into international law. Lemkin actually invented the term genocide, which was about the protection of groups in contradistinction to Lauterpacht's. And he also had been from the same region. So this, in the summer, really got me thinking. What was it about Lviv, Lvov, Lemberg, Leopolis if you're Italian, Lvov if you're Russian, I mean, that had caused two individuals, both Jewish, to have done what they did? What was it about that place at that particular moment in time? And of course, I couldn't possibly have an answer to that, either then or frankly now. It's a sort of matter of speculation. I'm not a historian. I read myself into a lot of books to try to understand the atmosphere of Lemberg, Lviv, Lvov, and the Jewish community. What was the experience that they went through? It seems very clear to me that their being Jewish was undoubtedly a part of what they did. They both came from reasonably religious backgrounds. I mean, they both had a Jewish upbringing. They lived in Jewish homes. They studied Jewish matters. They considered themselves to be Jewish. They had very different backgrounds in a sort of human sense. Lauterpacht was born, say, in this small town of Zhulkiev near Lviv. He came from a much more, should we say, middle-class, upper-middle-class household. There were books around, there was music around, people played piano, although not so well. And it was an ideas household in an explicit sense. Words, their meaning, their interpretation, their importance were very much part of his upbringing. He was a student in the city in the famous month of November 1918. To understand the city, you need to basically know that it was a city that was divided roughly equally between three communities: the Poles, the Jews, and what were then called the Ruthenians, the Ukrainians. And it was pretty tranquil. There wasn't much bloodshed around town, but occasionally there would be outbursts of violence. And there was one such outburst in November 1918 when Lauterpacht actually found himself on the barricades. And although I don't have evidence of it, I've long believed that it was that experience of being on the barricades on his parents' street, protecting the home, the family home and his parents' home, that must have caused him to start asking the question, I'm going into the world of law, how can the world of law protect the human being? Because that is the thing that marks Hirschlauter Pact. He grew up in a Lviv, Lemberg, in which the Jewish community was deeply divided in terms of the central question of identity. Who are we, first and foremost? Are we Austro-Hungarians? Are we Poles? Are we Jews? Are we individuals? Do we want to assimilate? Do we want to have our own schools? Do we want to have our own language? Do we want to have, you know? And just as in London in 2018, exactly 100 years earlier, actually I realize it is, we are exactly 100 years from that November 1918 point, there was just a myriad of different views. Some wanted a state of Israel at one extreme. At the other extreme, they thought it would be the worst disaster that would ever happen, and it must never happen. And then everything in the middle, you know. So that was the atmosphere. But in November 1918, things came to a head. And as the First World War was coming to an end, there was an explosion of violence. And the Jews found themselves essentially caught between the two warring factions of the Poles and the Ukrainians. And some would opt one way, others would opt another way. The vast majority just thought we'd keep our heads down and whatever will be, and we will live with whoever comes out on top. And whoever would come out on top was unclear. It was a world of rampant discrimination. I found that when I found Lauter Pact and Lemkin's student records. Everyone on their student records from 1915 all the way through to 1926 and beyond, the first line in the student records basically asked for your nationality. And you either wrote Pole, Mosaic, which meant Jew, or Ruthenian. There were very few Ruthenians. The Ruthenians were treated as the peasants, illiterate, uneducated, not for education, and it was very tough if you were Ukrainian to get into the university and to get into the law school. It was pretty tough if you were Jewish, but not as tough. And most of the names were Polish Catholics, and that was the vast majority. So there was a hierarchy in town. That coincided in November 1918 with the city changing hands in terms of control four times in the space of the month. First week of November, it was Austro-Hungarian. Second week, it was Polish. Third week, it was Ukrainian. Fourth week, it was Polish. And there was bloodshed. And there was bloodshed all around for the Poles, for the Ukrainians, for the Jews. And I've long thought that must have been the moment where Lauter Pact started asking himself the questions, how can we use the law to change and improve and enhance the well-being of the human being? And he spent the rest of his life thinking about that. It started with his PhD. He studied with a man called Hans Kelsen in Vienna, and he was already writing about these things in the mid-1920s and thinking about them when he came to London. He came to London in 1923. He became a professor at the LSE, or teacher at the LSE in 1927, and eventually moved up to Cambridge in the late 1930s. He lived a Jewish household, but not a deeply religious household. And one of the things, as I went forward with my research on Lauter Pact, that struck me very much and which resonated with me in a certain sense, was that as he became increasingly part of the British establishment, he declined to wear his Jewish identity on his sleeve. And I understand that, and I may be wrong, as essentially a tactical issue. Called upon to advise the British government and help then the Americans in dealing with the horrors that his own family were being subjected to, although he did not know the details, I suspect he took a strategic decision not to promote or self-identify or focus on the protection of the Jewish community above every other, because I think he sensed, probably rightly, that if he did that, it would diminish the role and effectiveness that he would be able to play. And I have to say that, bringing that fast forward to my own situation, until I wrote East West Street, I tended to downplay my sense of Jewish identity. And in part, it was the same sense. I think for Lauterpacht, with his Polish background, it was difficult enough that he was a foreigner. It would be even more difficult if he were to self-identify very actively at that period as Jewish. And that produces a consequence of the draft speeches that he wrote for the British Attorney General Hartley Shawcross, in which he makes virtually no mention of the Jews. It is incredibly staggering. He is prosecuting the man, Hans Frank, who is responsible for the murder of his own family, but he basically cuts out any focus on Jewish identity and Jewish victims. And I think that was strategic, and I think it was probably the right decision for him at that particular moment. I understand that. But it's plain that his sense of Jewish identification was very strong during his education and all the way through for the rest of his life. That his son Eli, who was my first teacher of international law, in our long conversations, made very, very clear to me. So he came from a bookish world. He came from a world of ideas. He believed ideas could change the well-being of the human person. And he is the person, as much as everyone else alongside René Cassin, on whom we'll hear more, who basically said, the law has a role in protecting the well-being of the individual, but it must focus on the characteristics of the human being as an individual. Not their colour, not their ethnicity, not their race, not their sexual orientation, not any group they are a member of. The simple fact that they are a human being. In contrast, Lemkin, who I think would have been very supportive of Lauterpacht's ideas, came from a different background. He did not come from the same kind of bookish middle-class family. He was born on a farm in a very small hamlet, which is now in Belarus. He moved when he was about 20 to Lviv, studied at the university. His upbringing on that farm was of exposure to local pogroms. And I think there's no doubt from his own writings that those pogroms in and around Bialystok and other places would have had a profound effect on his sense of security or insecurity, the well-being of his family, the well-being of his friends, and would have caused him to ask the question, how can I think about a way in which the law might enhance the well-being of human beings, and in particular, human beings who are particularly vulnerable, which generally means human beings who come from smaller communities rather than the dominant community. But he went a very different route from Lauterpacht. For him, and of course, any of you who've read East West Street will understand, I have a strong sense of sympathy and understanding for both approaches. And in a certain sense, the writing of the book was for me an oscillation between these two views. And even more than that, a sense of my own identity, the individual or the group. And that's the complexity that I struggled with in writing the book and still struggle with today. But his simple proposition was that people don't get harmed because of their individual qualities or what they have done individually. In the end, they get harmed because they happen to be a member of a particular group that is targeted at a particular moment in time or place. And so, starting in 1933, at which point he was a Polish public prosecutor, he started writing pamphlets about the need to protect the group. And his focus was on the protection of the group, of course, culminating in his invention of the term genocide. There was, between Lauterpacht and Lemkin, a tremendous tension, although it seems they never actually met. I think Lauterpacht was pretty sniffy about Lemkin, not a true scholar, not a real researcher, and Lemkin was a bit sniffy about Lauterpacht, head stuck in the clouds, ivory tower, blah, 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 not connected to the real world. And you can imagine the two of them together. At one point I said to my editor in New York, at Alfred Knopf, I'd like to write just a short passage imagining a conversation between them. And she forbade me from doing that because she said that it's a non-fiction book and the moment you introduce a hint of fiction, you just destroy the veracity for the reader. That was probably the right advice. But I think a meeting between Lauterpacht and Lemkin would actually make a terrific stage play because the tension between them is a tension they would have brought from their own backgrounds and their own communities as part of the local Jewish communities that they were both part of. But also it goes to an essential issue of human identity, which we all ask ourselves. Who are we principally and how do we define ourselves? You know, am I Philippe Sands British, French, Austrian, Polish, European, citizen of the world, citizen of nowhere? Am I white? Am I male? Am I an Arsenal supporter? Am I Jewish? I mean, how do I want to be defined? I'm all of those things, but how essentially do I want to be defined? And that's a really complex question for which there's no right answer. Lots of reasonable people can come to very different views. My instinct, my intellect, rather, is with my intellect is with Lauterpacht. I think he's basically right in his critique of genocide. That sense of fear that he has that the concept of genocide will replace the tyranny of the state with the tyranny of the group has essentially been proved right. And I fear that the concept of genocide has ended up doing more harm than good. It has reinforced the sense of group identity, it has reinforced the sense of hatreds, and it has probably given rise to the very thing it was intended to prevent. And I think intellectually that Lauterpacht was right. But I understand what Lemkin was doing, and he's right. People don't get harmed because of their individual acts. They get harmed because they're a member of a group, and the targeting of the group is a way to attack the individual. And that's what happens, and the law needs to reflect that reality. So that oscillation, which we can come back to in conversation, is, I think, an essentially Jewish preoccupation. Who are we? It is the heart of anti-Semitism, frankly, because there is always this sense that these people who are Jews, we can't really trust them because they're not really with us. They're not really British. They're not really French. They're, you know, they're of the other. They'll look after themselves before. And this question of identity, the tension between Lauterpacht and Lemkin, is one that is there, that exists, that many reasonable people grapple with in different ways, to which there is no answer and, I think, no solution. The final thing that I want to touch on, which is related to it, is could anyone who was not Jewish have written this book, East West Street, which I get asked quite a lot. And I think the connection with that, of course, is the question of why I did what I did. How could it have been that when I was 20 years old, I was studying law, basically hated it, apart from one class that I did with a wonderful Yorkshireman called Robbie Jennings, which was called International Law. And all of a sudden, it really resonated. And I thought, wow, this I can get into. This is sort of interesting. Now, how did that happen? There were no lawyers in my family. I didn't know a lawyer when I went to university. I'd never met a lawyer. I didn't know a barrister. I didn't know a solicitor. I mean, it was just a world that was completely unknown to me. How did I get propelled in that direction? And I've thought that it has to do in some way with my relationship with my grandfather, who is a major character in my book. And so it is in some way my own Jewish identity that caused me to open this door and perhaps overly obsessively, if you talk to my wife, definitely over obsessively, explore all of these issues and leave absolutely no stone unturned. So they are two remarkable human beings. At times, when I have my doubts about how remarkable they are, I imagine them in the Nuremberg courtroom. I imagine them. Lauterpacht was there on the opening day. Lemkin turned up a little bit later. They were never there on the same day in the courtroom. that they find themselves in this situation of being involved in the prosecution of, it turned out, and they only discovered it respectively in July and September 1946, more or less a year after the trial had begun, they're prosecuting the guy who has killed their own families in their entirety, dozens and dozens of people. Firstly, that gives me pause for thought because I can't even actually really begin to imagine what that must be like. It is so huge and so overwhelming. And then I think, how incredible. They didn't just curl up in a corner and weep. They got on with it. They didn't bellyache. They didn't complain. We know from reports of third people in relation to both of them that it was an intensely complex and difficult and overwhelming experience. But they got on with the job at hand. They wrote their books. They prosecuted. They dealt with the matters from a distance to the extent that they could. And it makes me feel towards both of them this extraordinary sense of warmth, because ultimately they were a couple of Polish Jews, but they weren't looking out for the interests of Polish Jews. They were looking out for the whole of humanity in their different ways. For Lauterpacht, it was about giving minimum rights for every single human being, irrespective of who they are. For Lemkin, it was about protecting every single group, irrespective of who they are. And in their writings, you feel this. They're using their own experience to try to catapult their work into a greater good. And I feel that very acutely as I go around the world talking about East-West Street, finding myself in places where there are no Ukrainians, no Poles, no Germans, no or very few Jews, India, Mexico, South Africa, talking about East-West Street. And the remarkable thing is that the writings of Lauterpacht and Lemkin resonate in all of those places, because every community grapples with exactly the same issues in different ways. Fundamental issues of human existence and human identity that have been articulated so beautifully by these two remarkable characters. I'll finish just with one final thought, and we can talk about it afterwards. I have on occasion wondered whether it is ultimately a helpful thing to have put the accent on the backgrounds of these two characters in inventing the concept of crimes against humanity and genocide. It has never happened. No one has ever said to me, look, there you are, it's the Jews at it again, wanting to take over the world with their legal concepts, their ideas for making the world a better place. No one has said that to me. No one has written that. I have not seen that. But deep inside, I have this slight anxiety that at some point, someone will start attacking these two concepts precisely because of who the driving forces were. Now, it hasn't happened, and maybe, and I hope, it won't happen, but I know I've got a slight anxiety deep inside that at some point, I'm going to be confronted with that argument. Look, a couple of Jews invented the entirety of modern international criminal law. Look what good it's done us. And that, I think, is something to have a conversation about. Adam.
Good evening, everybody. Is my microphone on? I think it is on.
Yeah.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here, and it's so lovely to see so many people turn up on a cold Monday, December evening. I'm honoured to be here with Philippe, who's a Jewish human rights hero of mine. I've just finished listening to his amazing new podcast, The Rat Line, which I hugely recommend. And I've had his sort of his voice in my wireless earphones for the last couple of weeks, so it's nice to actually hear it in person.
18 episodes.
Yeah, ten episodes. Yeah, it may feel like
you probably listened to it twice.
So I'm going to talk a bit about René Cassin, and in a way, it's good that we ended on Nuremberg, because Nuremberg and the Nuremberg trials is where I'm going to pick up the story. One bit. I've spent quite a lot of time over the last 10 years speaking to Jewish groups about human rights and trying to enthuse Jewish people about human rights. And it was only when, after I read Philippe's book, East West Street, and started stealing the concepts from that book to use for my kind of stump speech to Jewish audiences, that I actually started to resonate. And actually, it gave me the opportunity to go back onto YouTube and look at some of the Nuremberg trial videos, which are there. And it's really the opening section which sticks in my mind most whenever I talk about declarations and about the European Convention. And it's the phrase of Justice Jackson, the American chief. He was a Supreme Court justice that came to be the chief prosecutor for the Americans. And he said, he opened by saying that these trials are the greatest tribute that power has ever paid to reason, which I love as an idea. I imagine the scene in Gulliver's Travels where where he's being sort of tied down by the tiny threads of the Lilliputians, but they're kind of ropes for them. And I imagine power being tied down and bound by human rights laws until they snap, unfortunately. But René Cassin, I found out, I did some research, obviously, for this talk. One thing I didn't know is that this today is not only the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration, it's also the 50th anniversary of René Cassin's Nobel Prize, which he won in 1968 on the 10th of December to commemorate his work on the Universal Declaration. René Cassin, I'll talk about his life, but I want to start in the middle with the Universal Declaration itself. René Cassin was part of a 9-person drafting committee during 1947 and 1948, which included, I mean, Eleanor Roosevelt was famously the chair, but there were representatives from Australia, Chile, France, the USSR, the UK, Canada. No Africa there, in the most part, because at the time the UK and France represented Africa, because they were controlling most of Africa. And René Cassin, in his second draft, which was the sort of key draft, had a metaphor for the Universal Declaration, for how he would structure it. And it was a classical building. I've actually drawn a little classical building on my notes, which you probably can't see. And it's quite a sort of beautiful metaphor. And when you reread the Universal Declaration, which I've been doing recently for this anniversary, you kind of it gives you an insight into the reason it works. And it's interesting when you consider it in comparison to the imitators that it spawned, over 200 different treaties and laws, which have been based on parts of the Universal Declaration, but none has all of the same elements. So you start with the foundations, which are Articles 1 and 2, and within the foundations are the four concepts, all of which are mentioned in Article 1, and they are dignity, liberty, equality, and brotherhood. Brotherhood's actually something which doesn't appear in the European Convention, which is the great imitator, which you know is part of our international law and our binding international law from the UK and across Europe. But it really fits with the sort of worldwide conception of these rights, which had to allow for not just liberal capitalism but also communism and everything in between. So that's the foundations. And then in the steps leading up to this lovely sort of colonnade is the preamble. And it's worth reading. The preamble, amongst the entirety of the text, is perhaps the most that's sort of anchored in the time. Because and you really feel, you can almost hear the guns still firing. And you imagine we're in 1947, we're literally a couple of years away from the end of the Second World War. We're only, you know, 25 years from the end of the First World War, and this is an extraordinary time. Whereas disregard and contempt for human rights have resulted in barbarous acts which have outraged the conscience of mankind. And those barbarous acts have been exposed to a large extent in the Nuremberg trials, and the first set of trials ended only in 1946. So this kind of, and there's some great, if you go on YouTube, there's some fantastic films that were made for the Nuremberg trials to show to the judges, which are kind of dramatic, almost fiction-like, or it seems like fiction, depictions of the horrors of the Nazis, these barbarous acts. So those are the steps. And then you have the columns, the four columns, which are the four sections of the rights. So the four different kinds of rights. You have individual rights, so the rights that only that you have as an individual, not really vis-a-vis anyone else, but you have as an individual per se. So the right not to be tortured, the right to an effective remedy, and so on. And then you have the second column, which is the individual within civil and political society. So there you have sort of the right to privacy, which has sort of become probably the most controversial rights that we have in the Human Rights Act, this right to privacy, which really didn't exist to any large extent in English law until human rights law came along. It's one of the reasons why the Daily Mail doesn't like the Human Rights Act, because it stops them taking pictures of celebrities and exposing them on the front pages. And then you have the public political freedoms, which are, so freedom of conscience, for example, freedom of religion, which is the right that is protecting religious communities. Although religious communities are not at the centre of the Universal Declaration, they're right there. The Universal Declaration doesn't pretend that these communities, these groups, don't exist. But what it does, it places them in their proper context, which is subservient to the individual, or as part of individual identity, is probably a better way of putting it. And then finally, the fourth is socioeconomic rights. So these are the great sort of probably the untested or the least tested aspect of the Universal Declaration, maybe the next great frontier in rights protection. And then at the top, and this is, I think this is possibly the most interesting part in a way, and the most unexpected, is the top is the duties, and people often talk. If you listen to Lord Sachs talk about human rights, he critiques human rights, says that they miss out the obligations to society that's so important to building a healthy society. But the Universal Declaration has specific duties of the individual to society. It's not a right at all. They are not rights, they are duties. How can they sit together with rights is the fascinating question that those who then turned the Universal Declaration into binding and workable treaties, such as the European Convention, had to decide. And so that was the building that René Cassin built. Who is René Cassin? He was born in 1887, and he was born into a Jewish family in France. He fought in World War I, and where he was seriously injured by machine gun fire. And he became an advocate for disabled war veterans' rights, and that's really where he cut his teeth before becoming a lawyer in the rights game, as it were, although before it was probably considered as rights. In the 20s and 30s, he was a French delegate to the League of Nations, which was the precursor to the United Nations, where he argued for disarmament, peaceful resolution of conflict. And then during World War II, very much like Lemkin and like Lauterpacht, he saw a huge swathe of his family taken out, deported from Vichy France, and murdered by the Nazis. But he fled to England in 1940, speaking absolutely no English, not knowing what he was going to do. And Jewish identity was central to him, but as Philippe touched on, it wasn't the core of what he considered rights, human rights, were going to be. His biographers say, for him, the rights of Jews were not specific rights. They were the rights of everyone. So, again, the individual is the core actor, is the core unit of analysis. And then we have these memberships of groups and identity and identities. So he ended up in London, where he was part of the Free French government. And for his service, he had a death sentence put on his head by the Vichy authorities. So he would have been amongst the first up on the wall, against the wall, if the Nazis had invaded the UK. And he worked from 1943 for the United Nations War Crimes Commission, which was fascinating because the United Nations didn't yet exist. But the War Crimes Commission was quite a not very well-known body, but was involved in 30,000 investigations into war crimes. This was going on during the war itself, you know, building this. And one of the things you get from Philippe's book is this, that a lot was happening before the Nuremberg trial started, right at the very moment the war ended. A lot had already happened in preparation. And, you know, you had Roosevelt with his Four Freedoms speech. You had the United Nations declaration, and et cetera. So there was a lot going on to try and build an idea of what the world would look like if the Allies won.